about Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Jason Randall, and he'll be answering your questions on chasing trout in the chill, beating the cold, and catching more. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Jason a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill out the form on the right side of our homepage, and we'll let you know when the next live show will be. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website about 48 hours after the show ends. You can also find it on any of the podcast sites like Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pocket Casts, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website or any of the podcast platforms at your convenience and listen to the recording at any time. If you're out and about on Facebook, Instagram, or X, we'd sure appreciate it if you'd share our podcast. And when you do, use hashtag AskAboutFlyFishing and hashtag FlyFishing. In fact, if you have a moment while you're listening to the show, you can do it then, and we'd really appreciate it. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. When we return, we'll be talking with Jason Randall about chasing trout in the chill. Watermaster is dedicated to providing their customers with the highest quality inflatables on the market, as well as unbeatable customer service and product support. They are best known for their signature products, the Watermaster Grizzly, Kodiak, and Bruin rafts. These rafts are lightweight, compact, durable, versatile, and safe. The Watermaster rafts are everything your personal watercraft should be. They've been used by anglers and hunters all over the world. Visit Watermaster today and take a look at the ultimate personal flotation craft. Go to BigSkyInflatables.com. Again, that's BigSkyInflatables.com. Before we introduce Jason, we'd like to let you know about the great prizes we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to Fly Fishers International and a one-year membership to Trout Unlimited. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and look for the link under tonight's section that says Register for our free drawing. Click on that link and fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a book courtesy of Stackpole Books. It's going to be one of Jason's books. We're going to let you pick from one of his three books, and that will be the prize. Now, here's how you can win. You must be the first person to answer the question that I ask at the end of the show. And the question will be something that Jason and I talk about during the show. So take good notes, pay attention, and when the time comes, submit your answer along with your name and location using that text box on our homepage. And type fast. That's all I can say, because the first person in will get to win one of Jason's great books. Tonight, our guest is Jason Randall. Jason is a veterinarian certified in fish health and medicine. He is also a member of the World Aquatic Veterinarian Medical Association and Society for Freshwater Science. He has been an outdoor writer for the last 10 years, with articles appearing regularly in American Angler, Eastern Fly Fishing, and many other outdoor magazines. His first book, Moving Water, A Fly Fisher's Guide to Currents, was released in 2012, and it studies the effect of current on trout, their prey species and presentation, where vertical layers of the current create drag and requires adjustments to improve nymph fishing success. He published a second book, Feeding Time, A Fly Fisher's Guide to What, Where, and When Trout Eat, and that focuses on matching your fishing strategies, the trout's feeding strategies, especially when targeting large trout. Because if you know the five W's for large trout feeding, who, what, when, and where, and why, then you can catch them regularly. Jason also published an additional book, which was,
That was Trout Sense, and that was the third book in the trilogy. It's a Fly Fisher's Guide trilogy, and so Trout Sense was a Fly Fisher's Guide to What Trout See, Hear, and Smell. And then the fourth book that came out a few years later was Nymph Masters, Fly Fishing Secrets of Expert Anglers.
Right, right. So we've got three of those. I missed one of them on our website. So if you need to find out more information, you can find those on the right side of our homepage. But yeah, I mean, Jason's put a lot of words to paper. Let's put it that way. And it's all good. It's all good. So, hey, Jason, welcome back to Ask About Fly Fishing. We've done a few shows with Jason over the years, and they're always entertaining and enlightening and educational. So, folks, you're in for a treat. So welcome, Jason.
Thanks, Roger. It's great to be back. It's good to talk to you again. I look forward to seeing you at the Denver show. I think you've made it out there several times, and we've been able to catch up a little bit out there.
Yeah, it's in my neck of the woods. I think the last one, I was really sick, and I didn't go out for any of it. But yes, this year I'm feeling, you know, pretty good. I just have to stay away from my grandchildren. You know, that's that's those little germ bugs, you know, they're just germ factories, and every time I watch them, I get sick, it seems like. But
yeah, they're like 3-year-old incubators.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And I've got two, one that's one and one that's five, and they're right in the thick of it right now. So,
oh, yeah. That's the best.
But anyway.
Yeah, same, same.
Yeah, okay, good. So here we go. Yeah, we're talking about fishing in winter, and I noticed there were some people that had sent in questions and stuff from Canada, and yeah, it's always winter in Canada, I guess, right?
I was up in winter. I was up in Canada, I think it was in the summer, though, and was fishing on the Bow River, which is a magnificent, magnificent fishery in Canada. And I noticed the guy on the radio, the news broadcaster, said, well, hey, you know, there's two seasons in Canada. There's winter and July.
Yeah. I know. I grew up in Alaska in Anchorage, and it was a very short summer for us kids, but long days, but short summer. And I remember they had a graph in the Anchorage airport when you know, and it showed the tour. It was kind of like a bell curve when the tourists came to Alaska, and it was like a flat except for like June, July, and August. It went like whoop, whoop, you know, up and down just for those months, and then that was it.
Oh, yeah. Hey, they get a bump up in Marksville for the Iditarod. My wife and I, Joe, were up at the Iditarod several years back as veterinarians.
Oh.
It was an amazing experience. You learn so much, and you talk about adaptation to needs. It was obviously cold there, and those dogs are under such a tremendous physical and physical demand. Yeah, the one I came home with after helping as a veterinarian at the Iditarod was the average intake of calories for those dogs that are on the trail. Do you have any idea what that might be, Roger, understanding that the normal human consumption of daily calories is about 2,500? What would you guess for one of those sled dogs?
Oh, boy. I don't know. 3,500?
Yeah, would you believe 12,000?
12,000. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, 12,000. And so you talk about adapting to conditions. Yeah, those dogs are consuming 10 to 12,000 calories a day. And it was an eye opener. That's the one thing I think I remember most about that Iditarod experience.
Oh, nice, nice. Well, I wish trout were consuming those kind of calories a day. We'd catch a lot more, wouldn't we?
Well, you know what? The truth is that they wouldn't have that number of calories anywhere near available because the amount of food in the winter river is tremendously different than that what we see in the summer in May and June.
Right.
It's actually down. It's down by almost two-thirds. So the amount of available food in the river goes down tremendously, and trout have to adapt to that. And their own metabolism changes drastically on water temperature, too. So, you know, there's a balance there. And the more we understand that, the more predictable trout become. And, yes, we can definitely catch them in the winter.
Well, was there a particular experience or observation that made you realize winter trout fishing required a whole different mindset?
Well, like life's most effective lessons for me, that it's always come with a dose of humility. And certainly my first expeditions to the Winter River were abysmal failures. And it wasn't until I put myself kind of in the position of the trout and understood the circumstances that they faced and how they adapted to that. And the river, as we mentioned, so different than it is in the summer, and how they had to respond to that. So I think when I finally realized all that, then I found that, yes, trout are pretty predictable in the way they respond, and they change, obviously. They change their locations, they change their feeding strategies, and their whole priorities are much different in the winter than they are in the summer.
What triggers them transition from, say, their summer lies to their winter lies? Because they do move, right, to different parts of the river?
Oh, yes, they do. They do, and their priorities change as well. But the major trigger is going to be water temperature. Photo period would certainly have something to do that with that as well. Available light has something to do with that as well. But I think, you know, if we look at just kind of some truisms, universal truth, that trout really need three things from a feeding lie. They need food, obviously. If there's no food, there's not a feeding lie. They go to the feeding lie like you go to the dinner table. They go there with the intent to eat. They look for reasons to eat that rather than reject it. The next thing that they need from a feeding lie, since they are in stationary position, obviously they need something to bring that food to them, right? They need current then to bring that food to that stationary position. And the third thing that they need in a feeding lie is safety and protection, a certain amount of personal security in that position. They don't want to end up being someone else's meal. So they want to be safe. And that's kind of the ranking system that they use in water temperature that's a little bit warmer, say 55, 60, you know, in the low 60s. But when that water temperature falls below 50, they go into an entirely different mode. Remember again that the amount of food that they have to eat, potentially eat, is much less. Their metabolism is at a much lower level, and so they're not burning as much calories. But their priorities change. They're not on that aggressive feeding pattern. Food is not priority number one. In fact, priority number one is safety and protection. They just want to live through the winter. They don't want to be a winter kill statistic. They know they're going to lose condition and body mass in the winter. They just want to survive it. So they go into energy conservation mode. They're looking for slower, deeper water that offer a high degree of safety and protection. They'll eat food if it's there, but their current preference also is going to be much less. They don't want to expend those extra calories. They want to have maybe deeper, darker, slower water where food is still somewhat available.
Now, am I correct that some trout will move upstream to find different lies, or is that, am I correct about that? And if so, why?
Well, yeah, I think, you know, there's maybe a misconception that that trout move upstream always in winter, but in fact, for those fall spawning species like brown trout and brook trout, they move up into their spawning habitat in fall, and because the water is often warmer near the source, especially if that's spring source or, you know, maybe from a tailwater where that upstream water might be cold or it might be warmer in the colder temperatures of winter, they oftentimes stay there. And so they go up perhaps to spawn and they just kind of hold over up there because of the warmer water. And so I think one of the strategies that we often hear is that we need to move upstream to that warmer water closer to the source.
Now, I always wonder, you know, I look at streams here in Colorado and some of them are pretty skinny in the wintertime, and I'm wondering, how do these fish winter over? In fact, even just down here in the valley, it's called Deer Creek, and it's just a little creek. I mean, most of it freezes over, and I'm wondering where those, you know, there it's, they've got brook trout in there. But, I mean, I just don't understand how they can make it through the winter, I guess, you know?
Well, you know what? Again, if you put yourself in their position from their perspective, just think of this, Roger. If you were outside in a snowstorm, a blizzard, and you know, the temperature was falling and the wind was howling, and you had put on as many layers of clothes as you had and you were already shivering, you know, if you found a place that was 5 or 8 degrees warmer you would immediately feel a little bit more comfortable and at ease. And if you could get out of the strong wind, or in the trout situation, the strong current, you would also feel some relief from that. And so I think for them, when they find those types of waters where it might be a few degrees warmer, there might be some relief from the current, maybe it's by a spring input or a ground seep where there's a little bit warmer water coming into the stream, those are places where I think you would typically find trout, especially if there's the ideal kind of trout lies where they're a little bit, maybe a little more concealed, a little darker water, deeper water with that medium, slow-moving current. I remember one time I was fishing up on the Ruby River, and there was a sign that said Warm Spring Creek, and the first thought that came into my mind is, oh, this would be a great place to fish just down below that in January or February, because that is truly a warm spring coming in. Boy, that difference in water temperature would be a real relief for trout. And you know that trout are, they're called ectothermic. We are endothermic, meaning that we respond to changes or discomforts in temperature, thermal distress, if you will. We respond by shivering, or we respond by sweating if we get hot. Well, trout don't do that. And so the assumption then I think we sometimes erroneously come to is the fact that they're indifferent to temperature. If they don't respond to it, they don't mind temperature changes. Well, that's not true. They're very sensitive to temperature changes, but the way they respond is they just go seek out the warmest spot they can find with giving them the relief from that thermal stress. So they're going to find a little bit warmer water, get a little bit, you know, some relief from the strongest portion of current. And so, you know, I see people that are fishing in skinny, shallow riffles where the water's faster in January or February. And I've done that as well, too, in the past. But I think that's not the ideal position to find trout. They change positions and locations in the river. And I think if we anticipate that, we know that, then trout, as a whole, not only just in winter, but as a whole, they become a little more predictable. And if they're more predictable, they're more catchable.
Yeah, yeah. Well, leads me to my next question of how can anglers identify warm groundwater seeps or springs that attract trout in the winter? I mean, what you just described, warm springs,
it helps if there's a sign.
Yeah.
If there's a sign on the road,
three arrows pointing and flashing lights.
That helps.
Okay, I've never been that lucky, okay?
Well, I think you can identify warm water inputs in my streams here in Wisconsin. I'll notice that there's ground seeps in areas where there is an influx of warmer water in the winter. Oftentimes those areas are maybe a little spongy when the rest of the ground is frozen solid. You can kind of perceive that walking on the bank. Sometimes you'll notice them because they'll have cattail and certain types of vegetation that will indicate that there is a groundwater source there that's bringing warmer water into the river. Sometimes those areas, too, like on a recent snow, you know, if the water temperature is in that 40 range and the ground temperatures, air temperature is all about freezing, but this one area is a little, if there's a new snow or something, that area has already thawed the snow and you don't see snow on that area and that remains a little softer when you walk on it. I think those are clues. But also, I think you can read the terrain, too, and kind of notice where there's lower areas, and you can get those telltales by vegetation as well. So you can tell. Sometimes there's fog on the water, too. There'll be just a little wisps of fog where that water temperature is just a little bit warmer in that area.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. Or maybe lack of ice, if it's icing around the edges where there isn't any ice, I suppose. And Yeah.
That's true.
I think you had mentioned, I think, an article that you wrote about discharge zones appearing greener or where everything else is brown. Or why does that happen? And how reliable is that as a clue?
Yeah, that's something I would normally see maybe in the summer months where things do get a little drier and the grass starts to brown out. And you see one area where there's a little greener character to the vegetation, but also differences in character. I look for you know, like watercress and some of those, you know, small low vines that oftentimes are around groundwater inputs. And those areas tend to stay a little greener than in the winter as fall goes into winter. And they also, when the ground freezes up, those are the areas that tend to stay a little spongy underfoot. And I think we can identify them. If you know that river pretty well in the summer, you can kind of anticipate that too in the winter.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we need to take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll talk more about locating trout and reading the water and so forth, and so that we can catch more in the winter. So hang on, folks, and we'll be right back. The Ugly Bug Fly Shop in Casper, Wyoming, has been serving fly fishers in Wyoming and around the world since 1983. Their selection of top-of-the-line gear and a huge assortment of flies is one of the best in the land. All products are available in their shop and online. Looking for advice? Just give them a call, and their expert professional staff will help you with whatever you need. Visit the Ugly Bug Fly Shop today at uglybugflyshop.com or call them at 866-845-9284. Again, it's the uglybugflyshop.com or call them at 866-845-9284. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Jason Randall about chasing trout in the chill, beating the cold, and catching more. If you'd like to ask Jason a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Jason, I always ask my guests what's going on in your fly fishing world, and so, yeah, kind of enlighten us as to what plans you have over the winter here.
Well, it's been a fun fall. I've been pretty busy doing a lot of fishing, and I've got a school coming up in Missouri with a group called Fly Fishers at the Crossing. Looking forward to that. And I just came back from a training clinic with the youth Team USA, and that was so much fun and very enlightening. You go out there, I was invited out by Josh Miller, the coach of Team USA Youth, and taught a few sessions and a couple of programs, but you would learn so much. And I think that's the beauty of our sport is that you never quit learning. And so it was a great experience, met a lot of wonderful young anglers, a lot of other instructors too that shared information. And it was just a great experience. I think that's really an important part of our sport. Yeah, you can always learn more and become a better angler, because if you stop learning in our sport, you're the best angler at that point you'll ever be.
Plateaued, right? Plateaued.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And so it's been a fun fall. I've got the holiday period off. I'm going to be off between Thanksgiving and Christmas, be celebrating with my family and enjoying that time. And then it's after the first of the year, it's back on the show and educational circuit.
Okay, yeah. Are you going to be out in Denver this year?
I will be. I missed it last year. I was in Argentina, which is not a bad thing, but I sure do miss that show. It's one of my favorites.
Yeah, I've got some friends going. I don't know. You may know Terry and Wendy Gunn. They're going down to Argentina next week, I think. So.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, it's beautiful. If you ever get a chance, if you haven't been or if you have been, it's a wonderful place.
Yeah, I'm going down there with them. But in the spring, but to Chile for some big brown trout. So looking forward to that. Yeah, yeah. Well, good. And now, if people want to follow you, get a bit more of education from you, where's the best place to find you?
Well, probably the best is just to hit me up on Instagram. It's at Jason Randall Fly Fishing. And I do post a lot of educational material on there, especially if there's something that we might discuss tonight. I might put up, you know, a relevant illustration or something, a photograph or something that might help explain anything that we might cover tonight. And certainly in other educational programs, there's a lot of stuff on my Instagram site that is educationally oriented. You might see the odd picture of my dog or my grandkids too. So you have to you have to enjoy that as well.
Okay. Good. Great. Well, I look forward to seeing you in Denver this year, or next year, actually. The year's almost gone already, right? So back to our questions. What are the most common mistakes you see anglers make when they're trying to locate winter trout? You had mentioned the riffles. Yeah. before.
I think it's a habit. But, yeah, a habit we all fall into is just to go back to our favorite spots, and spots where we've had success before, and it might have been, you know, a spot that was really productive in May or June, but it's going to be a ghost town perhaps in January or February. And just understanding how trout adapt to the winter conditions, how the river changes in the winter conditions. And I think that allows us to anticipate where we're going to look for trout. It's entirely different places than we might look for them or find them in the summer. So typically I like to look at in rivers, I like transition areas, an area where there's an intersection of two water types. Maybe it's a tail out of a riffle or run where that water depth will get deeper and the current speed will slow because all the food that's carried up in the faster water in the riffles gets deposited and dumped and kind of settles down into the open mouths of wading trout behind those transition points as the water deepens and slows. But I typically find that trout may have their noses stuck right up against the change in current and speed and depth in the summer months, but in the winter months, they might be hanging back a little bit into the tail out, the slower areas of those transitions where the water's a little deeper and the current's a little slower. So that's just one example of where I might look for trout in the winter compared to where I might find them in the summer. And it would be a little further behind the transition zones where the water is already moving slower and it's deeper, offering availability of food and offering slower current and deeper water for protection and energy economics. So again, if you're that guy that's trying to get out of the snowstorm, once you get a little bit warmed up and once you get out of the wind and the howling driven snow, you're like, oh, okay, well, I think I'll have a cheeseburger. You know, you will eat. Yeah. But when yeah. you're really stressed in that condition where you're just absolutely frozen and shivering, once you find that little bit of a warmer position where you're a little more comfortable, then food becomes something that comes up.
Is there such thing as a too slow current when it comes to winter holding water?
Well, I think they still need at least trout that are in that middle stage of life where they're on stationary feeding lines. They still need current for the food delivery. That is the conveyor belt of food. Now, larger fish that are more what we call piscivorous, where they're more meat eaters, that's a different scenario a little bit, and you might see them in slower than expected current. But those trout that are usually in the range where we target most with fly fishing techniques of dry flies and nymphs, you know, those are the trout that are might be between 10 and 18 inches. They're still going to need some degree of current then to position themselves for food.
Okay. We did get a couple of questions in here. This one is just, it's kind of funny, and you kind of covered these things already. But James up in Idaho, he wrote and he says, the five things that I love about cold weather trout fishing. One, no mosquitoes. Two, less chance of getting dehydrated. Three, no complex hatches. Four, our western tailwaters shrink, concentrating fish in specific areas. And five, mid-hatches. That makes winter fishing sound pretty enticing in my mind.
I think James has got it dialed in. I mean, he makes a lot of really good points. I mean, if you look at the available food that trout have in the winter, midges is a number one food source, midges and scuds. Those are what we see most in the natural drift in the winter. So, I mean, that's right on. So midge fishing is, I like midge fishing too, especially it can be really, really cold. But if you get the first real good sunny day after some cloudy days, sometimes I think that can warm up the stream bed. The sun's rays can warm it up, and you can see. I saw the most prolific midge hatch I think I've ever seen on the North Fork River in Arkansas, and it was the first sunny day after several cloudy days. And boy, it was dynamic. The other thing you sometimes have happen is blueing olives. If you've got a winter generation of blueing olives, you can see something like that happen under the same circumstances. But yeah, I agree. No mosquitoes, you know, and there's less anglers too. You don't get as many anglers out in January than you do in May.
Yeah, you missed that one, James. You better add number six to your list. Fewer anglers. Yeah, but yeah, it's all true though. Yeah, and you know, the less mosquitoes or no mosquitoes is really important in Wisconsin where you fish a lot.
Oh yeah,
right.
Oh, that is very true.
Yeah,
very true.
The,
but I, again.
Yeah,
I love it. I love being out there. I love the peace and solitude of the Winter River and the no mosquitoes, the less angling pressure. And again, making those adjustments to catch trout, you're going to have a good day.
Yeah. Do trout behave differently in freestone streams versus spring-fed rivers during the cold months?
You know, I think they do, but on a different scale. You know, they act the same, but it's a different scale. I think if you look at a tailwater, it's just one giant input of comfortable water, then, you know, you can kind of relate that to the Spring Creek, which has multiple smaller inputs of warmer water. So I think if you look at it from that standpoint, maybe a tailwater is just an aggregate of several, maybe quite a few spring water inputs at the same time. It's just making a tremendous input of warmer, more comfortable water.
Right. Yeah, I'm wondering, you know, those tailwaters, do you think trout that are further downstream will tend to move up into those waters?
I think so.
During the winter months?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, it depends on, you know, what we call the thermal behavior of the river. If it rivers gain or lose temperature on a very predictive rate. And so I think if you really look at it from that standpoint, then I think they become something that you can predict as well as what the trout are going to do. Rivers radiate all their heat off at night to the blackness of outer space. If it's a cloudy night, it's like an insulating blanket. They tend to hold their temperatures a little bit more. On cloudy days, they don't warm up as much in the winter. You know, it's a solar rays that have more to do with the thermal behavior of streams and rivers than solely the air temperature that we might perceive.
Phil, can you reword your question about current? I don't really understand what you're asking there. Maybe you could resubmit it and I'll take care of it. Okay. Yeah, this is another one from Phil in Kentucky. He says, are larger trout less selective about what streamer they will hit in the cold because food sources tend to be relatively small?
Yeah, you know, streamers are, I think, an effective tactic in the winter. They can be. What I like is I like a warming trend where the water temperatures are on the rise and trout are feeling just a little bit of a happy boost from that, and they get a little more active. They're a little more willing to chase, I think, at that point. You don't have to put it right on their nose and in front of them. I think those make good streamer days. The opposite, when the water temperatures tend to be falling and it's overcast and cloudy and, you know, you're kind of in that funk of winter, I think at those times you really have to be kind of right in front of the trout. They're maybe not quite as willing to move for flies. They might not be as eager to chase something.
Yeah, there was another question from Mike in Richmond Hill, Canada, asking about streamers, just in general asking about, do you use them very often in wintertime?
I don't use them as much, you know, become maybe more of a nymph fisher and dry fly fisher. I love streamers. I don't throw them as probably as often as I should, and I won't profess to have a great deal of knowledge or expertise with streamers. I throw them as well as the average guy, but I probably just don't have as much experience with streamer techniques as I do with the others.
Okay. Talking about tactics and presentations, what adjustments should anglers make to drift speed, weight, depth, or do we just follow what we normally would do?
Well, again, I usually my winter go-to fly patterns are going to be midges and scuds because that's what the trout are seeing in the winter. Those are the blue plate specials that are available in January and February. And so I'm usually knowing that the insects and most of the food forms that trout feed on in the winter are in a smaller state of their development. Like most of the insects, when they go through their winter dormancy, which we call diapause, it's not a hibernation, it's more just of a diapause. It's a dormancy, a period of less activity. They usually do so in a less mature state than you might find them in April or May, where they're getting closer to emergence. And so they're usually smaller. They're usually less developed. That goes for most of the insects and a lot of the crustaceans as well. And so I'm usually going to use smaller flies to imitate those mid-stage nymphal life forms. And so I don't wing casings on most of them, because wing cases on nymphs are something that you see later in the developmental stages closer to emergence. So I'm using a lot of impressionistic flies. I'm going to use a lot of small pheasant tails, a lot of waltz worms, a lot of flies that are maybe could imitate a smaller scud, but also could imitate a small insect, immature insect. And so those would be kind of my go-tos at that point. And I don't need a lot of weight in the slower moving water. I just have to have a controlled sink. So if I'm nymph fishing, which I'm usually going to be doing in winter, unless there is some type of a midge hatch or a blueing olive hatch or something like that, or even winter generation of stones, winter stones can sometimes be fun too, then if I'm fishing slower, deeper water, I don't need a heavy fly that'll sink and hold and position in faster current. So I'll usually use size 16s and size 18s with maybe 2-millimeter beads or something size appropriate. And I just kind of do this measured sink. I'm allowing them to kind of slowly sink rather than bullet to the bottom. I don't use a lot of paragons in the winter for the same reason. I don't need that system to get depth and hold depth in fast water.
Oh, that's a lot of good information there. Jason in Kentucky, I hope that answered your question. He was asking about go-to patterns in winter months. And I think Jason just covered about all of them there. So, yeah, that's interesting about the stages, immature stages of insects, and how that affects your fly design and choice. I think that's super interesting.
If you're out fishing in the summer in Colorado and you're on the green drake hatch, I mean, all those flies, both dry flies and nymphs, will be representative of that activity right at that point. So your nymphs are going to be mature-looking nymphs. They're going to be large. They're going to have highly developed darker wing cases. They're going to be, you know, very active. You might even present those with a certain degree of animation in the drift, too, rather than a strictly dead drift. In the winter, I'm maybe a little less likely to animate a drift and maybe going more towards a dead drift. If I'm, you know, like in a spring blueing olive hatch, or I'm in a, you know, green drake hatch, those things are zipping all over, I'm more likely to use a little more animation in my drift.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We were talking about, you know, trout moving more slowly in winter. Does that affect your timing when setting the hook? Or redrifting, or that's something that doesn't change for us?
You know, I don't know that it's really changed for me. I mean, I'm certainly cognizant of the fact that they might be a little more sluggish. You know, the fish may play a little different when they're hooked, but I haven't really noticed if they're willing to commit to the fly, and I can do a good job of selling the fly as a salesman. Usually my hook set and everything else is usually fairly much the same.
Okay. Time to take another break, but hang tight, folks, and we'll dig in more with Jason on cold weather trout fishing. So hang tight. We'll be right back. Discover the power of pure Skagit and Olympic Peninsula Skagit tactics. From delicate soft tackles to hefty steelhead flies, OPST's versatile casting system meets the demands of every angling situation. With Ed Ward's unparalleled Skagit rod design and casting expertise, OPST offers you a quicker route to mastering effective casting techniques. Whether battling wind and rain or targeting steelhead trout or smallmouth bass, trust OPST's innovative rods, lines, and tips to elevate your fishing experience. Join the ranks of skilled anglers who rely on OPST for consistency, proficiency, and a superior fly fishing adventure. Unleash your potential with OPST today. Visit pureskagit.com. or call them at 206-858-8476. Again, that's pureskagit.com, or call them at 206-858-8476. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Jason Randall about chasing trout in the chill and beating the cold and catching more. So if you'd like to ask Jason a question, just fill out that form on our homepage, send it in, and we'll try to get an answer tonight on the show. Okay, let me just check here. Okay, here's a long one that came in on the internet here, Jason. Let me read this out to you. Since the new craze in fly fishing seems to be the Euro techniques, how effective would you rate that nymphing method versus good traditional double nymph rig and with a suspension device? Especially since you mentioned correctly that the trout tends to be in the deeper lies. I can't imagine you not catching your fair share with the standard nymphing rig or high sticking. Rick Parrish in North Carolina sent that in.
Hey, Rick, I was just out in North Carolina fishing about 3 weeks ago, and we had good water temperatures there. We were on the Tuckasegee and fished pretty well. But, again, I love Euro nymphing, and so it is one of my favorite techniques. But when you're talking about the slower-moving water where there isn't as much disparity in current speed from top to bottom, I think a good suspension device can produce fish in winter conditions. I certainly have some preferences. I think too often we use the largest plastic orb. It's like a Christmas tree ornament. And I think if we go to the smallest type of suspension device, something that's a little more subtle, I like a lot of yarn indicators. You know, Pat Dorsey's got his Dorsey indicator. I like the New Zealand style for suspending lighter flies. And I think that works really well in the winter if you're going to choose a suspension device. The thing I like about that is when it lands, it doesn't spook fish. And I think that cold water conditions really do concentrate fish, and we see them kind of in groups or pods. But if you spook them, they're still going to go off any feeding activity that they were doing, and you'll actually see them kind of get closer together in more of a defensive huddle, and you'll know when you've spooked them, even if they're kind of in a communal aggregate to begin with. If you spook them, they're going to tighten up and go into a defensive huddle. I think the larger suspension devices tend to be, you know, pretty off-putting to trout. And so especially when I'm using these smaller winter flies based on the food forms that a trout are seeing, I like those really subtle suspension devices like a New Zealand style indicator or a small, you know, yarn indicator of another type. And I think where suspension devices sometimes are most prone to failure is in faster current when there's a lot of disparity between the surface current and the bottom current where the trout might be, and that larger flotation devices then to have a good grip on that faster current. And I think they drag your flies along at a faster speed than would naturally be appearing to the trout. And so, but in that slower current with smaller, more subtle indicators, like a smaller suspension device, small flies, I think you can do pretty well.
So, Jason, are you saying that the orange pickleball that I use for the suspension device is too large?
You can see it.
I got to do something with those old pickleballs that I can't use anymore on the court. See, yeah, so
they're good for something. Yeah, and I, you know, I think that goes with the evolution of our sport. I mean, when we 20 years ago, I mean, we were using golf ball size devices, and they weren't very sensitive. You couldn't get a really good drift with them, and you know, you missed more trout than you caught. But I think with some of these newer products, you're going to be catching fish.
Yeah. Lots to choose from, that's for sure. I mean, gosh, you know, I think back to the old days when I started fishing, and I think the first ones I used were those little adhesive round dots, you know? Remember? You don't see those much anymore, but
they gummed up your line, I know.
Yeah. Yeah,
we won't mention any products specifically, but we certainly have come a long way.
Yeah. Good. Well, Brad in San Diego, California wrote in. He says, do you consider drop shot nymphing an effective method for wintertime cold temperatures and water?
Well, I kind of equate drop shot methods with like check nymphing in the Euro nymphing realm, where it's going to be a little heavier rig, more geared towards faster water where you need to kind of keep those flies in the zone, you know, a zone closer to the bottom. And so those aren't the typical water types that I find trout in the winter. And so although drop shotting does meet the three goals of nymph fishing, as well as many other systems, the three goals being you've got to get your flies down to the trout at the level where they're feeding. We call it either the strike zone or the target zone. Whether it's fast current or slow current, it changes. And the faster the current, the more narrow that strike zone is and the more compressed it is to the bottom. The second goal of nymph fishing is to get an effective drift, and that's a natural drift at the speed that the natural organisms are drifting at in that layer. So if it's near the bottom in fast water, that means it's moving slower than the overhead currents above. And then the third goal of nymph fishing is to have an effective means of strike detection so that we know, rather than putting on your pickleball strike indicator you know, that isn't very sensitive, we need something that's actually going to tell us when a trout picks up that fly. And so I think drop shotting, you know, again, it's very similar in many respects to the Euro nymphing categories we used to call Polish or Czech nymphing, where you're dealing with heavy flies and faster current. But I wouldn't necessarily go to those techniques in the winter river because mm-hmm. I think the trout are typically in different water types.
When you find an area that looks promising to fish, is there any particular way you work that area to be more effective?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, and I think, you know, when you find one fish in the Winter River, you typically find many. I think the cold water and also low water conditions, regardless of season, also they all tend to congregate or concentrate fish. And so typically I'll find fish in that suitable habitat, and I'll usually work from back to front in a group of fish, trying to hook a fish and then pulling them back, not to disrupt the rest of them, because you'll know when you disrupt them, if you can see the fish, you'll actually see them tighten their group. And it's a defensive huddle, just like schooling fish. They tighten up their ranks to look bigger and more intimidating to other predators. And so you'll know if you've alerted the pool. And I think you have less chances of alerting the pool if you work from back to front and try to pull those fish away and downstream of spooking the rest of the group.
What about a stretch of water that is more pocket water? Are fish holding in there in the winter, or are they moving out of there in other parts of the river?
No, they do aggregate in pockets as well because they can find current relief there, and it's usually a little deeper water. Remember that pocket water zones are depositional areas, and so food ends up being deposited there. They're like the corners of your living room where the dust bunnies gather, you know? The food gathers there. And if you look at pockets, they're usually behind the pockets, there's usually softer substrate, you know, kind of it's a little more softy and silty behind a pocket, a few feet behind the pocket. And then all the detritus live there. You know, it gets pushed there too. The decaying plant and animal material accumulates there. Know that also the midges and the scuds that typically are predominant in the winter natural drift are all detritivores. So when they get deposited in those pockets, as the silt and debris does, they stay there because the food is there, because that's the food they eat. And so there's a lot of studies in streams that show that there's a higher concentration of, like, scuds in those pockets. And so the trout line up on the trailing seams of those pocket water, you know, the ones that trail behind the pocket or the boulder, and they're on the intercept route catching food as it starts to sweep into that depositional area. A study out of Michigan showed that there's five times as many scuds on the lateral edge seams of a river as there is in the central part of the river, and that's because the current pushes the food to the lateral edge seams. And so that's another place to drop a midge or a scud. They both kind of aggregate to those types of areas. So pocket water, I think, is an effective technique. Again, look for the maybe a little bit further down from the pocket along those trailing seams where the current is a little bit less. The water might be a little bit deeper. But if you can find those features, I think you'll find trout.
Yeah, yeah. Now we got, this is probably one of your friends, but I got a question on the internet from Lombard, Illinois. Ring a bell?
Oh, no. Okay.
Okay, so, and I'm going to answer this question first. So.
Oh, good.
Eric says, any wisdom on how an angler's happy hour selection changes in winter months versus summer happy hours? Yeah, so.
Okay.
Yeah, I have some good, I mean, scotch is always straight up. It's just fine with the ale. I really like a rusty nail.
Yeah.
Good port is also nice for me, so. But go ahead, Jason. I had to answer that myself. So.
Well, I like your answers, too. There's nothing wrong with those. But Eric Camfield is, he is the director of Alter Fly Fishing Ministries, and we've had a long friendship and relationship over the years. It's just a wonderful group that serves fly fishers, and ministry kind of merges, you know, faith and flow, if you will. And we've shared many a Moscow mule together following some of the programs that we've done. And Eric's a marvelous fisherman as well and just a delight to our sport.
Yeah.
Great. So to answer that question, my drink preference is an apple, sour apple Moscow mule.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah, it looks like Kenny from Missouri knows that too.
I gotta keep up.
This other friend of yours, when the temperature drops and it seems maybe only midge fishing is best, when do you decide it's time to call it a day and grab a Moscow mule and sit in your living room and look out the window, right? So yeah, you've got some funny friends out there.
I do. These guys are great guys too. And Kenny Climes is another real influence in our sport as well. And he runs a program for men's anglers and serving men in that type of an environment as well. And he's got a group called Fly Fishers at the Crossing that's got over 300 members in it. That just tremendous guys and tremendous fishermen and just an effective, wonderful group of people.
Great, great, terrific. Nice to have good friends like that.
Yeah.
Our sport
is full of them, don't you think?
There's so many
wonderful things, and our sport attracts us just the right kind of people.
Right, right. Time to take another break, but we'll be right back and talk more about cold water fishing with Jason Randall. So hang tight, and we'll be right back. Fly Fishers International needs your support. Its conservation projects at both the national and club level are addressing critical issues of importance to fly fishers. The organization provides grants to help with the restoration of habitats like Wolf Creek in Idaho and Sands Creek in Delaware County, New York, and funds projects that collect valuable data about fish and their habitats like the peacock bass study in Miami, Florida. FFI serves as a strong advocate for fly fishing in all waters for all fish and to preserve and promote the arts of fly casting and fly tying and to help ensure future generations can continue to enjoy these one-of-a-kind experiences. These efforts won't be nearly as effective without your help. If you're not already a member, we invite you to join Fly Fishers International as they work to cultivate conservation, education, and community within the sport of fly fishing. Join Fly Fishers International today and help support their fine work. For more information, go to their website at flyfishersinternational.org. That's flyfishersinternational.org. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Jason Randall about chasing trout in the chill, beating the cold, and catching more. So if you'd like to ask Jason a question, just go to our homepage at Ask About Fly Fishing and fill out that Q&A box. Jason, we have a question here from Phil that he clarified here. And we've been talking about streams and stuff, and he has a question here about lakes. He says, much like a current in a river, wind-driven wave action in lakes is often seen as pushing fish to feed where the waves have pushed food. Do you think that idea holds up in winter conditions, or is it best to find warmer water wherever the wind is blowing?
Well, it sounds like Phil already knows more about stillwater fishing than I do.
Okay.
I do know that much, that wave action, and, you know, I know kind of the basics about stillwater fishing. And honestly, at the training camp that we did, there were some, you know, because stillwater fishing ponds, lakes, or locks are part of the competitive world, they have to be able to fish those as well. They had some really great, talented stillwater fishermen out there, you know, like Sean Crocker and some of those guys. I learned a ton out there, but I won't profess to have any great deal of expertise in still water. I do know the wave action can push food around. I know a little bit about the littoral zone and the profundal zone, but honestly, Phil, I'm going to pass on that question because I just don't have the background in that area.
Okay, good. Okay, that's fine. Let's see here. Okay, there's another. How should anglers decide whether to change flies versus adjusting presentation?
Do you that's a great question.
Is that different in the winter than it is in the summer for you?
It's going to apply to both conditions. Okay. In any conditions.
Okay.
Is that I find myself changing flies a lot less often than I used to. I mean, I used to just paw through my fly boxes trying to find the hottest fly, you know, and wondered why that didn't work and went on to the next. But typically now, I know it's more relevant and applicable to nymph fishing because when we're nymph fishing, we're not trying to match a specific hatch or a specific condition. We know that trout are feeding from a wider array of food forms and they'll accept a wider array of flies then as a result. So I think they're not as fly specific. As long as we have a good fly that might pass for a number of different food forms, we're in pretty good shape. So what I usually do rather than changing flies is I change me. I change, maybe it's me, I'm presenting it wrong. Maybe I'm not getting the drift that I think I am. And so I'll try to change, or I'll change depth. If I'm nymph fishing, maybe I'm not reaching the strike zone. Maybe my flies aren't where I think they are. I'll also, if I've tried a few dead drifts and I've not had success, I'll try a few animated drifts. I'll try to maybe do a little bit of jig to that fly, or if it's a squirmy worm, maybe I'll shake the rod tip a little bit to make that worm dance, or leeches too. You can do a hand twist retrieve on some of those things to add a degree of animation. If it's a hopper, I'll twitch it back towards shore. I'll skate a caddis. I'll also like to do an egg-laying caddis where I'll put a dry dropper, but I'll put my dry fly on a tag dropper maybe 5 or 6 inches with a weighted nymph maybe, you know, 24 inches below, and I'll dab that on the water surface using the weighted dropper to kind of anchor and draw that fly back down. So I find myself changing something about the way I'm presenting the fly, and then if that doesn't work, then I'm going to change flies. But I find myself also changing more, especially in nymph fishing, for depth and that type of thing than I do for the specific fly itself. If I open my nymph box and showed it to you, you're going to see about maybe 6 patterns, and they're all organized by weight, more or less. I think the tendency in our sport is we have so many different flies, we don't even know where we got these flies. We only have 3 of them, you know, but we still keep them. You know, we haven't used them for 10 years. That old 90-10 rule is that we use 10% of our flies 90% of the time.
Yeah, yeah. So that's a very good thought, and we should probably all process that. There's a place here on the North Fork River in Colorado, that's the North Fork of the Platte, right near me. And I was down there one day, I've changed up since then, but I had a full vest on, right? I mean,
oh yeah.
You know, I must have had 8, you know, different fly boxes in there. I mean, it was like putting on a 20-pound backpack, right?
I used to carry a hardware store around with me. I clinked and tinked like the old tin guy.
Yeah. Yeah, and this guy, he had like nothing. And, I mean, he just had his waders and his rod, right? And he was talking, and he says, I was trying to tie something on. I don't know, we got in the conversation. He goes, well, I've just really simplified. And he took out his little pocket and his waders. It was like an Altoids box, right? You know, mint box, metal box. He opened it up, and I don't know, he had about 20 flies in there rattling around, all pretty much nymph patterns, you know. He goes, this is all I carry anymore, and that's it.
Yeah.
And he closed it up.
I've kind of gotten that way myself. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I've switched over to a little chest box, you know, and trying to take what I need for that day. And I should know what I need for that day. I shouldn't be carrying around green drakes when it's May in Colorado or something. You know what I mean? It's
that's true.
We need to do more research before we go out, I think, many times. But anyway, go ahead. Do take it from there.
Yeah, I used
How
to
do you
do
organize?
Same thing. Yeah, yeah, I mean, I've got a few flats of nymphs and a couple of other patterns, leeches, and a few jig streamers and stuff. And then I've got a box of dry flies that are more universal that pass for multiple different species. But I moved away from carrying around a lot of flies that I don't use that I picked up at some river that might be very specific for that river, but it's really not something that I use again.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Do small degrees of warming trigger feeding? And is there a way for anglers to recognize that and take advantage of those short windows?
Yeah, and I think it has more to do with sun, too. You know, notice that air temperature changes a lot more rapidly in both directions, rising and falling, than the water temperature does. It's more, air temperature is more labile. It changes more rapidly, but sun, it's like for you, if today here in the upper Midwest, it was maybe, I don't know, 42 degrees or something when I woke up. And, you know, I went out first to go out and walk the dogs, and it was kind of chilly. But I went out 2 hours later, and the sun was out. It was only 2 degrees warmer, but I didn't use my coat. It was because the sun was out, I felt warmer. And I think that happens with trout as well. I think when the sun warms up the stream bed a little bit, the insects get more active, and I think it happens to the trout as well. They might perceive and get just maybe a little more happy in that happy mood.
Can that work in reverse too? I remember I was up on the Bighorn River one year, and it was, I think we were in end of September, October, but it started snowing, and then this blue-wing olive hatch just came off. I mean,
yeah.
Thousands and thousands of blue-wing olives all over the place. And it seemed like when it got colder, the snow, I don't know, right at that moment triggered them. And it wasn't a warming effect. I don't know. Is that possible?
Well, I think blue-wing olives, yeah, they do like those cloudy, misty days and maybe those little bit of a snowy day in the winter. And I think if you do have a little bit of sun on the stream bed and for maybe a while or even a day or two, and then all of a sudden you get that weather moving in, I think that is a trigger for blue-wing olives for sure. That's kind of the classic blue-wing olive weather.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Greg Nichols in Loxley, Alabama says, how do you keep your line from freezing up on the rod and the eyelets? I know we all have that problem.
Yeah.
Oh, you don't? Okay, okay.
You know, it is a problem, and you can dip your rod tip in the water, and that dries it out, that thaws it out for about 5 minutes, and then that water freezes again. So, but what I find myself doing is I just really shorten everything. So I'm going to be shooting from shorter range. And so for me, if it's dry fly, I don't have that much line outside the rod. So I'm not recovering 40, 50 feet of wet line through my guides and then recasting it. And for nymphing, the same thing. I tend to just kind of keep that line outside the guides. I don't recover it through the guides, and I just recast. Maybe I'll hold some slack or excess line in my line hand and then play that out rather than bring it onto the reel, that type of thing as well.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting. Yeah, I was winter February once in Colorado, and we had that problem, but then my reel started, the drag in the reel started binding up.
Yeah. And see, I don't recover a lot of line.
Yeah, so I fixed that by taking my little flask of scotch out of my vest and pouring it into my reel.
Yeah, there you
the
go.
The alcohol wasn't freezing, so it loosened it up.
That'll work. But I just don't recover. I don't recover slack line into the reel if I can avoid it. I'll just hold it outside the reel in my slack hand and in my line hand. And you try to adjust to it. I don't know. How do you have a secret to keeping your rod tip and your guides from freezing up out there in Colorado?
No.
I don't know. If there is, I don't know it.
I was wondering if if you could put silicone in them or something. I don't know. But
well, maybe somebody can chime in here in the last half hour and give us an idea.
Yeah, anybody out there know? Yeah. Okay, now this is the next section we're getting into, too. We talked, several of you wrote in, Jason in Kentucky, about go-to patterns. Camille in Dallas just wanted to recognize you. We kind of went through that. Jeff in Calgary, Canada. Only place to fish in Calgary in the winter is the Bow. What flies do you recommend for walk and wade? Your previous recommendations
Yeah, but
stand
in
there
the
as
Bow
well.
River, they've got a real advantage up there. They've got those two water treatment plants up there. What is that called? Fish Creek, and I can't remember the name of the other one, that bring in a warm water source to the river, and they also bring in a lot of nutrients. As a matter of fact, you can see it in overhead satellite images in the summer. You can see this green change following those inputs, and so it's very well processed. It's a kind of a state-of-the-art wastewater treatment facility. It's really elegant, but it does bring in warmer water, and it does bring in higher degree of nutrients, and so I would probably be just fishing downstream of those spots. And I think, again, my flight choices would be relevant to the composition of the winter drift in that river. And I think it would still be, I still think I would at least start with those midges and see what happens.
Okay. Okay. Phil, down in Apex, North Carolina, asks, for cold weather fishing, where is one of your favorite locations to go and why? Do you have a go-to fly for this location? Yeah, where do your winter fishing? Any
Well, you
particular
know,
states or areas?
The Florida Keys.
Yeah, that's Belize is where I go.
Argentina is nice. But yeah,
anywhere south of the equator, right? Yeah.
I love fishing my home waters in the winter. Now, in Wisconsin, our trout streams close October 15th to the first Saturday in January for the spawning of our brown trout and brook trout, our native species here. But, you know, when that season opens up, I love fishing, you know, my home waters. I've got a tradition where a buddy and I go out, Tom Starmack, and we fish the opening Saturday. And one time we did it in Wisconsin, it was like 8 degrees. And we met, you know, I had plenty of coffee, and you know, we sat in the cars with the heaters running. And we both ran out, caught one trout, and said, okay, see you next year.
But I
enjoy it. I enjoy fishing my home waters in Wisconsin. And again, I do a lot of small fly fishing. And my go-to flies would be the ones we've pretty much already mentioned. The one maybe that we didn't mention, I use a lot of France flies as well. And some of the smaller nymphs like that really are effective. Because
the what
I think,
flies?
Again,
I'm sorry. Could you repeat
the France
that,
flies?
Jason?
Yeah, I use a lot of France flies in different colors. It's a thin-bodied, small, very lightly weighted fly, but it passes for so many different things. I mean, you could mistake it. Trout could mistake it for a small insect, or it could even pass for a small scud.
Okay, let's take the last 5 minutes and talk about our comfort as fly fishers.
Stay in
we
the
had a
truck
couple
and
questions.
Drink coffee.
Yeah, I'll come back next year. Yeah, I'll have to use that one sometime. Greg in St. Louis says, what type of winter gloves do you prefer, wool or synthetic? Do you use?
But
Do
I
you
tried
have
to use those fingerless gloves until my fingertips were numb, and then I went away from those. And I've got an old pair of Sims that are synthetic that I use for steelhead fishing here in the upper Midwest, and I do like those. But I don't like heavy gloves. I don't like wool gloves because I can't feel anything with it. And I would actually, you know, if I could get away with it, it wasn't that cold, I would avoid gloves altogether and just, you know, rotate my hands in my pockets once in a while. Because with the lighter leaders and tippets and materials that I like to use for nymphing, especially in that lower, clearer water of winter, I need to feel that in my fingers. And so I get frustrated if I'm using something that prevents me from having that feel.
Yeah, that makes sense. Phil wrote in here, he was asking about how to keep your hands warm, and he says, I might change flies more often if I could feel my fingers.
That's true. That's true. That's where the truck comes in handy again, too. You go sit in there, warm them up in the heater, and then change fly.
Yeah, so Phil, if you were listening earlier in the show, remember Jason said that he doesn't change flies as often anymore as he used to.
No,
so
that's
you
true.
Can, yeah, so you don't have to change that off. Just get the fly where the fish is, right?
Yeah, and that's true. And again, if you can change something with you, either if you're your own nymphing, change your sight or angle to give it a little bit different look to that fly, you know, or give it a little different sink type of characteristic, something that'll change that and it might trigger that. But, you know, all kidding aside, you know, I do love to be out there on the water. And if I get cold, my hands get cold, I shove them in my pockets. I dress for it.
Yeah.
I wear something that will break the wind. I wear some real dense, almost like an Icelandic wool sweater sometimes under a rain jacket, even if it's not raining, because that jacket will break the wind. And then I have head protection, and sunglasses are a must too, especially if you get a lot of glare on a sunnier day.
Oh, yeah.
But if I'm dressed well, all kidding aside about hovering and being in the truck, I'm out there on the water because if I do it right and I'm in layers, I'm pretty comfortable. And if my hands get cold because I do have a thinner glove on, I just stick them in the pocket and take a break for a minute and just enjoy peace and quiet of the river. Let my hands warm up, and then I'm back fishing again. So I think making some of those adjustments, again, will keep you comfortable and keep you on the water.
Well, I'm going to read, Kurt wrote in a note here on the internet. I think he's tried everything, but I'm going to read this to you. He says, how do you keep your feet warm in the winter? Mine tend to shut down. I hydrate and take aspirin. That helps, but I have to take off my boots and waders to rub them and warm them up. Toe warmers run out of oxygen in my waders and shut off too quick.
Yeah,
so you haven't talked about
true.
Feet. Any... yeah,
well, actually, if you're in the water, sometimes it can actually be warmer. The water is 40 degrees and the air is 10 degrees above zero. You know, being in the water can actually be a solution. But there are days where it's just tough. You know, and then being an upper Midwest steelhead junkie, I love to go steelhead fish and try to get out there for those migratory species at least once or twice or three times a year. It gets pretty cold. It honestly does get pretty cold, and you just have to try to make whatever adjustments you can and then be sensible about it too. If you really can't get over it, then take a break and go have a cup of coffee.
Is there, and you being a veterinarian, is there anything you can tell us about safely landing and releasing trout because of their state and winter state of being not as energetic, maybe not being able to recover as easily as in the summertime?
I think that's true. You know, and again, you know, they're a little more sensitive to energy loss. They don't have the ability to replace lost energy as quickly. So, you know, fighting them for a long period of time in winter conditions could really exhaust them to the point of, you know, being very detrimental. They may not be able to replace the energy they lose because of the limited availability of food. So, but typically winter trout don't play that hard and aggressively in those conditions because they're a little bit sluggish, and so they're literally usually a little eager or easier to get to the net. And I think if you can get there, again, fighting fish, if you can get their head to the surface, you can just kind of walk them across the water surface. If you get their head out of the water, you've landed the fish. You just have to bring them to the net. And so I think getting them to the net a little quicker will help avoid depleting their energy reserves.
Last question from Phil in Apex, North Carolina. Jason, you're a great author and your books are great. Will we see another book from you?
And I know Phil really well, too.
Oh, okay.
He's a great guy. I've known him for many years and a very serious, very intellectual angler. Really good. I enjoy the conversations we have together. But I think, no, I really haven't had I think you get to the point where you've said what you're going to say in the sport. I think I'm at that point, at least in written form. I love to teach in person. I love to do presentations. I love to do the shows. I love on stream and on water teaching. I do a lot of that one-on-one teaching in small groups. And I think I've really, really kind of enjoyed that so much that I don't think there's another book in my future.
Okay. All right. Well, good. Totally understandable. Totally understandable. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. We've got to wrap this up. And as usual, you know, we could keep talking all night long about fly fishing. There's always something to learn and always something to share. As you said, it's a great pleasure to share. But we need to move on for tonight. We are going to give away our prizes here, a one-year membership to Fly Fishers International, a one-year membership to Trout Unlimited. and one of Jason's books, courtesy of Stackpole and Headwater Books. So hang tight, and we'll give those away in just a moment. The Bonefish and Tarpon Trust works very hard to safeguard the future of our beloved flats and fisheries, from protecting spawning sites threatened by unsustainable fishing pressure to securing historic funding to restore Florida's Everglades and estuaries. Thanks to their members, they've expanded their conservation to the Bahamas, Belize, and Mexico. There's still much more work to be done, and they need your help. With your support, they can ensure that the flats fishery is healthy and sustainable now and for generations to come. Visit btt.org and become a member of the Bonefish and Tarpon Trust today. Again, that's btt.org. Just a quick reminder to everyone before you leave our website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what did you think of the show? Just click on the link. Leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Now it's time to give away our prizes. The winners for our drawings are randomly selected from our show's registration database. If you didn't register for tonight's show, it's too late now, but make sure you do so for our next show so you don't miss out on a chance to win one of these great prizes. If you are one of the lucky winners, we'll contact you after the show and so that we can collect your information so that we can deliver your prize to you. So first, we'll give away a one-year membership to Fly Fishers International. To learn more about FFI, go to flyfishersinternational.org. If you don't win tonight, I suggest you join anyway. They're a great organization to support. The same with TU, both great organizations. Let's see here. Our winner for that is Mike Giovedoni in Alabama. Sorry, Mike, if I destroyed your last name, but anyway, congratulations. We'll get your membership going for the FFI, and we'll be contacting you after the show to do that. And then our one-year membership to Trout Unlimited, again, a great organization to support. TU.org is where you go to find out more about Trout Unlimited, TU.org. Our winner for that is Mitchell Prelowitz. Again, I can destroy last names readily here in Michigan. So Michigan and Alabama represented tonight. That's great. So Mitchell, congrats on winning that TU membership. And now a chance to win one of Jason's books. Oh, Eric says you have a good way of using forceps to tie flies in cold temperatures. All your friends out there. Okay, I'm just clearing my cue here to get out all the riffraff. Okay, so this is going to, I've never done this before, but, and I can't let your friends win this one. So the question is, I mentioned three drinks, cocktails that I like in the winter months. Name one of them. Name one of them that Roger likes. Now, you can't say Moscow Mule because that's just Jason. So name one of the three that I mentioned, and then you'll win one of Jason's book. See if anybody was listening to our last.
Hey, I could name them.
You could? Okay. Well, you already have all your books, so you can't win, Jason. So it'll take them a minute because there's a slight delay, and then they have to think, and then they have to type, and they should be all warm. Their fingers should be working. They shouldn't be outside. And, yeah, I think I got a winner. Well, I should know, right? Yeah, James in Idaho, Scotch is one of my favorites. And, Greg, you had one right, too, but you're second in line, Rusty Nail. Kenny, you got it right, too. They were listening. They were listening, yeah.
All right.
So, but the first person in was James, and James has been a longtime listener of the show. So, James, send me your shipping information so I have that. And take a look at Jason's books and pick one out that you like, and I'll get Stackpole to send that over to you. So
you should buy him a drink, choice. Roger.
I should buy him a drink? Why?
Yeah. Well, because he won. He guessed your drink.
Well, he's getting one of your books. Okay. Well, James, stop on by. I've got plenty of scotch, port, and the scotch and drambuie for a rusty nail. So, yeah, just stop on by. You're welcome to a drink anytime. You too, Jason.
Okay. I will.
Yeah. Hey, Jason, appreciate you being on the show again with us. Always a great show with you and a pleasure to talk to you. And thanks so much for sharing all your knowledge. We all appreciate that.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure. Good night.
Yes, good night. Hopefully all of you have found the podcast archive on our website. If you haven't yet, just look for the link in the top line of our menu. In that archive, you can search for all of our past shows, over 425 shows, I think. You can search by keyword, keyword phrase, whatever you'd like, you know, whether it be trout, tarpon, winter fishing, things like that. Go ahead and explore. I think you'll be pleasantly surprised. Our next broadcast will be on November 19th, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern. On that show, I'll be interviewing Rick Kustisch, and our show will be on Great Lakes Winter Steelhead, Chasing Chrome in the Cold. Some more winter fishing for you guys and gals out there. Rick is just getting started when icy winds sweep across the Great Lakes, and most anglers pack it in. Rick shares his proven strategies for finding and catching winter steelhead in freezing conditions, discover how these powerful fish adapt to the cold and what flies trigger their strikes, and the best techniques for slow, deep presentations when water temperatures drop below freezing. Whether you're a diehard steelheader or dreaming of your first chrome in the snow, Rick's insights will help you to turn your winter's chill into your hottest season yet. So be sure to add that to your calendar. You can do so on our website. Just below Rick's picture, it says add to calendar. Pick your favorite calendar, add it to your calendar, and we'll see you live on that show. I'd like to thank Fly Fishers International, Trout Unlimited, Bonefish and Tarpon Trust, the Olympic Peninsula Skagit Tactics, the Ugly Bug Fly Shop, and Watermaster for sponsoring our show tonight. And don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future live broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.